Welcome to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Today on the program, we've got BYU's honor code, a national monument, the sale of the Salt Lake Tribune, and much more. And joining me this morning in studio, reporter Tony Semerat is with us. Tony, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Also with us, Tribune senior political reporter Robert Gerke. Hi, Robert.
Hi, how are you?
Health, education, and environment editor Rachel Piper is here as well. Hi, Rachel.
Hello.
And environmental reporter Brian Maffley joins us. Good morning, Brian.
Hey, thank you.
And you are welcome to join us with the stories on your mind this week. You can put comments at sltrib.com, send tweets to the hashtag TribTalk, or call us. 801-355-TALK is that number. 801-355-8255. Rachel, we've been following this story out of Brigham Young University for over a week now on how they handle rape allegations. And earlier in the week, a group of protesters marched to the president's office to deliver what? Tell us about this petition.
The petition was started by BYU student Maddie Barney, who's sort of become the center of this issue. She reported her sexual assault to police last year, and the Honor Code office at BYU got a hold of this police report and sort of started an investigation into her for information that showed that she had broken the Honor Code. And so she says that this has prevented her from signing up for classes, just being continually harassed to come in and talk to them before they'll do anything. And she's also dealing with a criminal case. So she started a petition online on a site called Care2, asking BYU to have an amnesty clause in their honor code that says if you come forward, you report that you've been sexually assaulted, you are sort of immune from these other portions of the honor code that might get you in trouble for having someone in your room or having at any time in your college career, you know, had a drink of alcohol or something like that. That petition now has, when they delivered it, it had over 90,000 signatures. Now it has almost 110,000.
And although Maddie Barney is sort of the front for this movement, she's hardly the first or the only person to bring up these concerns about how the honor code is implemented, right?
Right, right. And a lot of people have come forward in the past couple of weeks to share their own stories with this. At Wednesday's protest, a lot of women from, you know, who were attending in the 90s, attending in the 80s, said, this happened to me, this happened to a friend, I never came forward, you know, because I knew that this kind of thing happened to people who did come forward.
BYU, I believe, last week issued a statement. This week they responded with a video on a willingness to change policy. Expand on that.
Yeah, so on Monday they released a pretty lengthy statement sort of outlining what they feel the strengths of the honor code are and what, you know, how that is a good thing for the school, but at the same time saying, you know, we do occasionally refer students to the honor code when they report a sexual assault. They sort of in the past have said these are two very separate procedures. We never send a victim right to the honor code office. They did acknowledge this week that sometimes they do. They look at someone's sexual assault report and say, okay, we're also going to send you to the honor code when this is all done. So they said that they are going to be reviewing these policies and looking at possibly some structural changes in that. And also on Wednesday, the morning of the protest, BYU President Kevin Worthen released a video statement saying that he hopes at the end of their review of this that they'll have a system that protects people and that people can trust rather than feel pretty angry about as they do now.
Now, this isn't enough to preclude Maddie Barney from filing a complaint.
Right.
What is that complaint?
She filed a complaint with the Federal Office of Education and their Office of Civil Rights, basically saying that BYU mishandled their Title IX investigation, which is part of the schools who receive federal funding have to comply with Title IX, which basically ensures that students have equal rights to campus services and their education, basically, without fear of discrimination based on their sex. So her complaint is that they basically didn't let that happen for her. They sort of prevented her from getting an education because of this honor code investigation.
So protesters are scrutinizing BYU. Local law enforcement is also in a bit of hot water. Tell us about that angle of the story.
It's sort of complicated because everyone has a different story. The Provo police, you know, they she came to them and they started looking into her rape. And a deputy with the Utah County Sheriff's Office knew the defendant, the man that she accused, and the defendant gave him a copy of her police report, and he took it to BYU. And now his boss is saying he did it sort of out of the goodness of his heart. He was really concerned that there was these other people on campus who were doing bad things, and he wanted to protect athletes, and it's this sort of interesting explanation for why this happened. And a lot of people are questioning that explanation, and I know that we'll probably see more on this.
And people are also questioning the district attorney's role in how he interacts when he's prosecuting rape, how he interacts with the Honor Code Office. Mm-hmm. That's a bit of a tangle as well.
Yes, yes. He sort of is wearing two hats. He has a civil hat and he has a criminal hat, and he's sort of using both of those at the same time to say, well, I know this information from my civil role, and so I'm going to use it to not prosecute someone and not tell anyone what that information is that I gleaned from this other role that I have.
President Worthen, in his statement, did he say when the school's new structural changes or policies would be laid out? Did he give a timeline?
There's no timeline. It has been mentioned that, you know, BYU's commencement was yesterday. The school year is done, and they want to have student involvement in this. And so I don't think this is going to be something we're going to see in place until at least later this year, possibly later.
Certainly an issue that the Salt Lake Tribune will continue to chase
yes.
vigorously. Let's move on to another story that, well, it at least shook up our newsroom. It caught the attention of everybody at the Tribune, the sale of the newspaper. Tony Semerad, who is buying the Salt Lake Tribune?
Well, after what sounds like about 18 months of negotiations, a member of the family of John Huntsman Sr., a fellow by the name of Paul Huntsman, will be buying the newspaper through the family's private equity investment fund, which is about a $1.1 or more billion-dollar fund that the family had set aside for kind of diversified investments worldwide, really, but mostly they focused domestically of late. So Paul Huntsman, the sixth son or daughter of John Sr., I'm told a very astute businessman, a lot of very well trained, a lot of experience in the U.S., Asia, and Australia. Has been, you know, running companies since graduating from the Wharton School. I'm also told a very digitally savvy person, and they've combed through this deal very extensively.
Do we know anything about the deal? How much did he pay for the Tribune?
We know very, very little, but there are some details that are starting to emerge. The whole transaction is contingent on making some sore spots go away.
So it's not quite a done deal.
No, it sounds like there's a little ways to go before they close the transaction. And Paul Huntsman has said, you know, he won't be commenting, he won't be visiting the newsroom until it's appropriate, and the deal's kind of sealed. But a source says the deal is contingent on a federal lawsuit targeting the Tribune and the Deseret News business partnership going away. And they also need to satisfy antitrust lawyers at the Department of Justice who've been looking into this thing for more than 2 years.
Hmm. Why did our former parent company, say they're selling the paper?
Well, that's an interesting question. They've been making some mixed moves in the industry of late. They, of course, as folks may remember, they tried to sell the whole chain last year to another hedge fund, and that didn't work out. And so they've been gradually kind of peeling papers off and selling those individually. But then they jumped in and bought a bunch of or two, you know, very prominent papers in California. So it's been kind of hard to read just what their business strategy is. And again, Digital First Media, owned by or major shareholder of Digital First Media, is a New York-based hedge fund that specializes in what's called distressed assets. So they're their strategy in general is to sort of hold on to distressed properties for a while, get what they can out of them, and then sell them. So it's always been sort of presumed that they would want to sell it. But they've been hard to read lately.
Paul Huntsman has not appeared in the newsroom. Why does he want the Salt Lake Tribune?
Well, that's a good question also. I have to think there are business and civic reasons behind it. The relatively uninformative press release that came out about this on Wednesday said, you know, they're honored to be stewards of the paper. They're thrilled to have a business of this kind of quality and stature is what I believe they said. And, you know, Huntsman Sr. announced intentions to buy the Tribune, as I say, about 18 months ago. It's been out there for a while. And his stated reasons are to preserve an independent journalistic voice and to kind of stand up for diversity in the community. And so, I mean, I would say the critical mass of their motives are civic. I don't think they're getting into the newspaper business expecting to make millions of dollars.
Well, if only he knew that magical recipe, I think all of us would be thrilled. Do you know if Paul is representing the family's interests or his own?
Well, so one advisor to this deal characterized it to me as kind of a generational play. That, you know, John Sr. is likely to be involved. He's very interested in this, but he is, you know, getting up in years and has ailing health to a certain extent. And, you know, Paul, 46, you know, kind of represents, you know, the next generation in all of this. And, you know, just what their strategy is in terms of how the paper's managed and how it's run, we have yet to find out.
Hmm. You mentioned that the sale seems to be contingent on a couple of things happening. The printing contract between the Deseret News and Salt Lake Tribune, that being sorted out, mm-hmm. as well as a DOJ investigation. What about the lawsuit? There is a group of former Tribune employees that is suing. Does that need to go away for this sale to go through?
Well, it's a big part in all of this. And just exactly what cog in the machinery it is, we, you know, it's not exactly clear. But yes, in fall of 2014, I want to say a group of former Tribune employees and advertisers and kind of generic readers sued over this joint operating agreement between the Deseret News and the Tribune, which was rewritten about a year before and put the Tribune in a significantly sort of disadvantageous situation in the partnership. And there's been worry that, you know, was a potentially fatal financial blow over time. So this group has been suing and has actually been getting some traction, an attempt to kind of get it thrown out, the lawsuit thrown out early on was not successful, and it had come down to the nitty-gritty of discovery, which, you know, is essentially the judge ordering both sides to kind of produce documents. And that was starting to get uncomfortable, if you can judge from the filings. The one thing we do know is that this deal is contingent on that lawsuit going away. That lawsuit targets the unfair, as they perceive it, aspects of the JOA. So I think we can presume from that the JOA is going to get rewritten. So there is the attorney confab to beat all confabs on Monday, where they'll all be getting together at one of the downtown law firms to kind of discuss whether this thing can go away happily.
Okay, stay tuned for that. Meanwhile, our editor and publisher, Terry Orm, sees distinct advantages to local ownership. What are those reasons?
Well, he has spoken repeatedly. You know, the Huntsmans, as a prospective buyer, have been out there for a while, and his comment is that he would prefer, you know, a local owner. He considers somebody that's kind of plugged into the community and has those interests, you know, at the center of what they're doing would be for the best for the Tribune. But he's also very open about the fact that a local owner necessarily means an owner that could potentially have conflicts of interest on the ground. And that's something that he's stated we're going to have to watch that, you know, in his words, goes without saying. But he's generally very, he seems to be very favorable to the idea of a local owner.
Obviously, this means a great deal to all of us in the newsroom. But what does it mean for readers?
Well, that, I think the bottom line there is that this appears to be a step towards long-term financial sustainability for the Tribune. With the change in the JOA, there was a our revenues from that partnership essentially were cut in half. And I'm told that that was not a sustainable kind of business model going forward. All the parties involved in this are saying that, however the joint operating agreement and the business model's changed, it's putting us on a more sustainable footing. So I think for the average reader, this is at least a glimmer that the Tribune will keep on doing what it's doing and keep this independent journalistic voice in the state and in the community.
Tony Semerad, thanks so much for that update. And again, you can find out a lot more information at sltrib.com. I know you need to scoot and do some more reporting. Thanks for coming in today.
You bet. Thank you.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW in Salt Lake City, throughout the state of Utah on Utah Public Radio. We need to take a break. We'll be right back. Stick around.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Headspin Events, presenting the 5th annual Cache Grand Fondo bike ride through Cache Valley and ending in downtown Logan. To benefit Logan Regional Hospital, Saturday, July 9th, registration information available at cachegrandfondo.com. And the Utah State University Alumni Association, celebrating 100 years of the Aggie Block A with an Alumni True Aggie Night. Friday, April 22nd, from 7 to 9 p.m. Information at alumni.usu.edu.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, joined in studio by Robert Gerke, Brian Maffley, and Rachel Piper of the Salt Lake Tribune. And again, if you want to join our conversation about the week's news, you can send tweets to the hashtag TribTalk or put comments at sltrib.com. Let's move on to a big environmental story this week, the potential of a new national monument designation by President Obama is causing all sorts of tensions on Capitol Hill and beyond. There was a Public Lands Commission meeting this week where lawmakers passed two resolutions. So, Brian, what are these resolutions?
Yeah, the more important of the two is the one urging President Obama to to avoid a quote-unquote unilateral use of the 1906 Antiquities Act to designate monuments in Utah. And obviously, the thing that's driving this is the possibility of a monument being designated for the Bears Ears region before the president leaves office in just a few months.
And where is Bears Ears again?
Yeah, I think people, we ought to talk about that. Bears Ears Buttes is a sacred spot in San Juan County that's in the heart of a much larger landscape that the monument proposal is targeting. And those lands include Cedar Mesa. That's the area west of Blanding that was occupied by ancient Native Americans for hundreds, if perhaps even thousands of years. And it's full of archaeological sites, tens of thousands, depending on who you ask. It's 100,000 or 50,000. Either way, it's a lot. It's covered with sites and burial sites as well. There's many, many areas where people have been buried. And then this landscape kind of extends into the Abajo Mountains. That's the area east, west of Monticello. Almost 2 million acres are involved in this proposal that has been largely cultivated by Native American groups. The central one is called Utah Dene Bekea, whose board are Navajo, Utah Navajo, who kind of hew to traditional beliefs. And the proposal's been kind of picked up by many of the other tribes in the Four Corners area. So what it kind of drove this resolution was this perception that Obama would designate such a monument without the sign-off of San Juan County leaders or interacting with the people of Utah.
Can you describe the testimony that we heard, particularly from those who favor a monument designation?
Yes.
Who spoke?
Yeah. The Commission for the Stewardship of Public Lands held a interesting meeting on Wednesday. It was disturbing and entertaining all at the same time. A lot of harsh accusations went back and forth. And the witnesses, the invited witness for that was a San Juan County commissioner named Rebecca Benally, who was going to offer the point of view that the commission this narrative that the commission wants to put out, that this proposal for a Bears Ears monument is, you know, really being orchestrated by environmental groups or groups from outside of Utah. And to rebut that, other Native Americans appeared at this commission meeting, along with dozens of environmentalists who wore Bears Ears t-shirts and held up signs during this meeting. I mean, it was a packed audience, at least 70 people in the room, dozens of others in an overflow room. I mean, people have very strong feelings about this. And the crucial witness who came on behalf of the people who were supporting a monument was a Ute Mountain Ute tribal council member named Regina Lopez Whiteskunk. And, she came to say, look, this proposal is one that is grassroots. It's supported by Utah Native Americans. It should be taken seriously.
And critics, legislators in particular,
yeah,
they're not buying that.
They're not. And at one point, Mike Noel, the Kanab Republican, basically accused the supporters of Bears Ears of being paid off, essentially, by groups like the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance and Grand Canyon Trust. There's really no evidence of that. I mean, I've been following the story for a few years, and this Utah Dene Bekea seems like a genuinely grassroots organization. I talked to the executive director of the group afterward, and he said, look, our board members are not paid. They get stipends for appearing at quarterly meetings. And the organization has a variety of funding sources with large and small individual donors and foundations. Now, I guess SUA and Grand Canyon Trust, more than likely, wholeheartedly agrees with the monument proposal, but does that mean they're the puppet master? I don't see any evidence of that. However, the critics of the monument are kind of still perpetuating that idea, and it got to the point where Mike Noel actually said this: all this tribal buy-in we're seeing from at least two dozen tribes. He called it a charade. That's pretty powerful, and. I think what we're seeing at the Public Lands Commission is this tendency to not really try to gather information and find facts, but really to press a certain point of view. And that point of view is this, Utah's being victimized by a federal government and in this case, a national monument is really being manipulated by outside environmental groups, as opposed to a homegrown initiative that it really appears to be.
Hmm. All of this, of course, comes ahead of a visit by Interior Secretary Sally Jewell this summer, and it has people very nervous about what's going to happen, including the governor.
Yeah, on Tuesday, the day before the commission met, she gave a major speech describing these quote-unquote course corrections for conservation on public lands. And she did not mention Bears Ears by name, but she did call out Utah. She plans to come out here and visit this summer and address some of these conservation proposals. Obviously, Bears Ears is something that she's going to talk about. But, the worst-kept secret in Washington is the fact that the Obama administration is giving serious consideration to a to this 2 million acre monument proposal. Of course, we have this history here of 20 years ago, a similarly sized monument was designated, came out of the blue, out of the Clinton administration, and there are still a lot of negative feelings about that today. And the Grand Staircase Escalante Monument, it's probably one of the reasons why the land transfer movement is so strong in Utah. Mm. But this time it's different. We do have local groups and tribal groups who have spent a lot of time developing a meaningful proposal for a monument. And I think if you read between the lines of what some of the things Sally Jewell, Secretary Jewell, said in her speech on Tuesday, she talked about, you know, not looking at kind of broadening the view of how we look at conservation, not small little pieces of land here and there, but landscape level. And the Bears Ears proposal is a landscape level proposal. And these monuments that President Obama has authorized or designated in neighboring states, a lot of them kind of hew to that landscape vision, the ones in Nevada, California, New Mexico, Colorado. Utah's like the last one standing here of these western states that hasn't gotten an Obama-designated monument yet. So I think everybody thinks it's going to happen.
Meanwhile, the Public Lands Commission approved these two resolutions. The full legislature is going to take those up mid-May, right?
Yeah, of course. May 18th, there's a special session. Immediately after the Public Lands Commission passed the resolutions, one of them, the one regarding the Antiquities Act, Governor Herbert agreed to put on the agenda for the special session and put out a statement urging all the lawmakers to get behind it. He's definitely on board with this idea that the Antiquities Act should not be used, quote-unquote, unilaterally. But the whole point of the Antiquities Act was to allow unilateral action on the behalf of the nation's chief executive. So, basically, they're asking for the Antiquities Act to be thrown out. Is basically what they're asking.
Hmm. We'll continue to follow that story. Another environmental story that you've been reporting has to do with a coal port in California. Using local money to build this export hub stirred up a lot of debate during the session here in Utah. Now the issue is getting tied up in California politics, and beginning with the concerns you report of the mayor of Richmond, about 10 miles north of the proposed site. What are his concerns?
Yeah. Well, his name's Tom Butt, and he and about a dozen other mayors in the East Bay have similar concerns about the possibility of a lot of rail traffic coming through their communities, hauling up to 5-6 million tons of coal a year that would originate from Utah. This weekend we're running a pretty in-depth story looking at what's going on in California's legislature to intervene in the proposal to build a export terminal in Oakland, California. The port is already being developed. It's an old Army base that's owned by the city of Oakland, and it's being redeveloped into a port. The proposal at play here is for an export terminal being built on the site that would handle a variety of commodities. However, it's pretty clear regardless of what people say, coal is the major commodity here that would be loaded, transloaded, and shipped abroad. Maybe half of the capacity. It's a 10 million short ton capacity a year. About half of that would be devoted to coal. So why? So the California legislature is pondering four bills. The central one, and all sponsored by a Democrat from Berkeley named Lonnie Hancock. She's a senator. The key bill is SB 1277, I believe is the number. Not that that matters, but it would require additional environmental analysis of this port project to specifically look at the impacts associated with handling coal at that site. There have been multiple environmental reviews already. None of them have addressed the coal issue, probably because no one knew about it until last year when the four Utah counties who produce coal indicated that they were going to invest $50 million into the project. 53 when you include all the administrative costs. So what's happening is that Utah's major coal producer already ships a couple million tons of coal a year through a nearby port in Richmond, California. And he came to one of these Senate committee meetings in Sacramento last week. There's some more this week. Explaining, you know, the trains coming through our community are leaving, they're depositing coal dust, and the port operators have to hire street sweepers to come and clean it up periodically. And so basically he's trying to say, look, there is an impact to these local communities that have to, that, you know, where the coal trains pass through. That's, and the state of California should be getting involved. However, there are something known as federal preemption in this arena where the transport of coal is already regulated by federal authorities. So state and local, which ties the hands of state and local officials. The mayor of Richmond, believes there ought to be much greater latitude on the part of the municipalities to regulate it.
I guess the bottom line question for people in Utah, what does this mean for the port?
Yeah.
Is Utah going to get the access that it wants, that it's going to pay for?
Yeah. Well, that's a good question. There just is a lot of political pushback in the East Bay, very politically liberal place. Very engaged with the climate change debate, and the state of California has, codified a number of policies aimed at reducing global greenhouse gas emissions, allowing their ports to be used to export American coal to Asia. Would really undermine those policy goals, and you know, California has already made this commitment to get its electricity from non-coal sources, which has also had an impact in Utah because the biggest power plant in Utah, Intermountain Power, burns 4 or 5 million tons of coal a year, and all that power is exported to Southern California. To comply with these policy goals, that power plant will have to switch to natural gas in the coming years, and that will be a huge blow to the coal industry in Utah when that happens. A fourth or a third or so of the coal extracted in Utah is burned in that power plant. So, you know, in a sense, California, by forcing the IP, Intermountain Power, to switch its fuel source, is kind of forcing Utah coal producers to look to Asia to sell its coal. And so how do you have to go through California it's an extremely interesting scenario. And at the end of the day, the state of Utah needs to recognize that the folks in California really feel that they should have a say in what gets moved through that port.
Mm-hmm. It's a story that you can read a lot more about online, sltrib.com. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Let's take a call. If you want to call in, 801-355-TALK is that number. Carl is calling from St. George. Carl, thanks for waiting.
You're welcome. I know you've gone well past the BYU rape case, but I wonder if I could make a comment on that.
Sure.
It seems like there's a real conundrum here, and I want to just quick down here in St. George, there are some high red cliffs above the city, and there have been people that go out on those cliffs and they've fallen off, and then they turn around and sue the city for not having railings and warning signs and such up on those hills. I wonder if there's a parallel between that and this gal that has been swapping arms about the way the university has handled her rape case. And I don't want to minimize at all the violation of rape and the tragedy of it. But I don't know whether this has come out or not, but if she's been at a party or she was at a party where there was drugs and or alcohol, and if she was part of this and was raped, I'm wondering if there's some kind of a mitigating circumstances there where the way that BYU handled the situation was that bad, because she was in violation of the honor code, if that was the case. Now, we heard whether she was under the influence of alcohol or not.
I'm not sure.
No. She was on a date. There was no drugs or alcohol.
I think Carl, thanks very much for the call. I think that Carl raises an issue that a lot of rape victims hear, mm-hmm. that somehow they have been responsible for the violence that's been perpetrated on them.
Mm-hmm. Well, if I could just jump in here real quick. It seems like in that circumstance that Carl raises, even hypothetically, if there was drugs or alcohol or she was at a party or whatever, that's something that could be handled by law enforcement during the course of a criminal investigation, not an honor code violation that on the back end of this that's going to end up getting a victim in trouble and getting them thrown out of school. So those are there could be consequences for those actions, but that's the issue is that it needs to be handled by proper authorities, not necessarily by the university punishing.
Yeah. But it seems like one of the ironies of the honor code is it almost seems to be exploited by perpetrators to, you know, avoid to ensure the silence of their victims, and that's an unintended consequence. And I think BYU is maybe grappling with that right now.
You know, someone who worked on writing the Clery Act, which is this federal law that, you know, requires universities to report violent crimes, said, you know, a lot of schools do this. They go after minor violations, and, you know, he asks, what do you want off your campus? Do you want the violent criminals who are raping people, or do you want to go after the relatively minor crimes? You know, I think the Red Cliffs metaphor, you know, it's less about she fell off a cliff. It's more that she was up on the cliffs and someone came up and pushed her off the cliff. So it's a little bit different there, I'd say.
Hmm. It'll be very, very interesting to see how BYU handles this, because they certainly have created a firestorm of criticism and calls to action. And it'll be interesting to see where this federal investigation goes, Maddie Barney's claim. Again, if you want to join us, 801-355-TALK is that number. Let's move on to politics, because it's sort of a big political weekend, Robert. We saw in the lead up to the state party conventions tomorrow, gubernatorial candidates announcing their running mates. Tell us who's on board.
Well, yeah, this is sort of the state party conventions, both the Republicans and Democrats state conventions are going to be on Saturday. So we saw the some of the campaigns bring out their lieutenant governor, their running mate, announcing those. And so Jonathan Johnson, the Republican who's challenging Governor Herbert for the Republican nomination, announced that he's chosen Robin Bagley, who is a bit of a controversial figure. She drew some criticism right out of the gate. She's a principal up at an alternative high school up in Davis County.
Charter school, isn't it?
The charter school, yeah. And she also, though, was one of the leading people behind the school voucher movement, which you remember was passed by the legislature and then overturned, I guess, by a citizens' initiative. And so, you know, that raised some eyebrows, I think, out of the gate. She was asked if she's still a voucher supporter, and she said she is. But she doesn't anticipate vouchers being an issue for Utah. And there was also some criticism, frankly, from some of the education establishment about some of the results that her high school has gotten in terms of the graduation rates and truancy rates and things like that. Vaughn Cook, who is one of the Democratic candidates, picked Jan Garbett, who is the wife of Bryson Garbett, the home builder here in Utah. They own that company.
And a new Democrat.
She said she had been a Democrat when she was attending BYU. She'd worked for Congressman Wayne Owens' campaign, but then changed to a Republican. Bryson had been a state legislator on the Republican side for a period of time, and he's not changing his political affiliation, so he's going to remain a Republican. It was an interesting story because Vaughn Cook, the candidate, had not actually met Jan Garbett face to face until Monday morning before they announced her that she was joining the ticket, which was kind of they had Skyped, or I guess they used FaceTime on their iPhones, and had texted back and forth a little bit and talked on the phone, but that was the extent of their interaction before they announced this on Monday. And then Monday morning she went and changed her voter or party affiliation, and they had a press conference to announce it.
Love at first sight.
Yeah, and the third one, Michael Weinholz, he announced Kim Bowman, who is an administrator up at the University Health Science Center, and he's on hiatus right now. He had been running for Salt Lake County Council for several months, was headed toward a primary with Christine Cantor for the Salt Lake County Council
seat.
Catherine Cantor, thank you, and dropped out of that race to run as Weinholz's lieutenant governor and endorsed Catherine Cantor. So those are the three LG candidates. I don't know that they necessarily are game changers in any of the instances. I don't know that the LG necessarily brings a lot of voters in, but it's an interesting sort of their first big decision, I guess, of the campaign again as we head into the conventions.
Well, lieutenant governors can be outspoken in a way that governors can't, and we saw a bit of a dust up between Jonathan Johnson, the Republican challenger for governor, and Herbert's LG, Spencer Cox, on Twitter. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, Spencer Cox, Lieutenant Governor Cox, has always been a fairly outspoken social media presence. Earlier this week, the governor ceremoniously pretended to sign a bill that was this resolution on the calling pornography a public health crisis. And Jonathan Johnson had tweeted, or the campaign had tweeted at least, that, you know, praising the legislature for passing this resolution. And Lieutenant Governor Cox tweeted back at him and said, well, you left out the governor, you know, he's the one who signed it into law. And, you know, he said, P.S., I'd really appreciate it if Overstock, which is Jonathan Johnson's company, would stop selling pornography online.
And included a link to the porn site.
Yeah. And then followed it up with another tweet that, you know, because Jonathan had said, in the aftermath of this public health crisis, this pornography resolution, Larry Flint, the publisher of Hustler, had said he's going to start sending copies of the magazine to all of the legislators. And Jonathan Johnson had tweeted how disgusting he thought that was. And it's like, and then Spencer Cox again came back and said, you know, oh, well, it's also, you know, maybe you should stop selling Larry Flint's products if you think it's that disgusting. So there was a little bit of back and forth, a little bit of tension. And frankly, from the governor's perspective, from the governor's campaign's perspective, it's probably the ideal scenario for them to be able to raise this issue because, you know, it's not something that's going to come out in the campaign otherwise. But, you know, by the lieutenant governor responding to comments in this social media realm in sort of an unfiltered and you know, in an unfiltered manner, they can put that issue out there. And it probably worked for Governor Herbert's campaign.
Only got a couple minutes before we need to head to a break. What can we expect at these conventions? There is some considerable tension between the Republican candidates for governor.
Yeah, no, I think that's going to sort of be the highlight of the Republican convention. There is some question about whether I think the common Jonathan Johnson can get the 40% they need to go to a primary. If they do, they you know, both of them will run until June to be in the primary ballot. And there is a little bit of tension there. Governor Herbert down at the Utah County Convention got booed for his defending Common Core, defending the educational curriculum that he's put in place. And then on the Democratic side, it's sort of the same equation. The gubernatorial candidates, we're kind of watching to see if either of them can get the 60% to win the nomination, or if we're going to have a June primary there as well. And then there's a couple legislative races down ticket that I think we'll watch. Probably not any major upsets in the wings, but you know, we keep an eye on them.
Mm-hmm. So you'll be busy this weekend.
What better way to spend a Saturday?
What better way to spend a Saturday? If you're curious about what goes on in conventions, interesting. interesting story in today's Tribune, sltrib.com. Check it out. A new study by Utah Foundation showing that these conventions do tend to attract the most extreme views rather than those in the middle of the party. Again, check it out, sltrib.com. We need to take another break, but we'll be right back. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW in Salt Lake City, throughout the state on Utah Public Radio.
Hey, what's up? I'm Shad. W. Kamau Bell is hitting the road in a new travel show called United Shades of America. Next time on Q, the comedian will tell us about his voyages into racist subcultures, including the Ku Klux Klan. That's coming up on Q from PRI, Public Radio International.
Join us this afternoon at 1 on Utah Public Radio.
On the next Backstory. In the 1820s, there was a campaign to establish a separate Jewish state in upstate New York. And the most enthusiastic supporters? American Protestants.
The vast majority of Americans have never laid eyes on a Jew, but Jews and Israelites and the Old Testament had a huge place in the American imagination.
A history of Judaism in America, this week on Backstory.
Join us Sunday afternoon at 1 on Utah Public Radio.
Behind the Headlines, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune, and time for our final segment, the underplayed story of the week. Brian Maffley, kick us off. What you got?
Well, I wrote a story for today's paper. I don't know how it was played yet. I haven't looked at the paper.
It may be underplayed. We'll see.
This week, prosecutors in Wayne County filed charges for concerning the theft of dinosaur bones. Turned out to be state lands in down by Hanksville. What made this story remarkable were three things. First of all, that someone actually got caught for stealing dinosaur bones. It's a big problem, and almost never is anyone caught. Secondly, this was a group of college students on a geology field trip from a community college in Texas. It was three students and two sponsors. I think that's a fancy word for a chaperone. They went back home with 60 pounds of bones near the Burpee Dinosaur Quarry. And then, but most significantly, was a statement put out by the School and Institutional Trustlands Administration, a.k.a. CITLA, thanking the special agents of the Bureau of Land Management for solving this crime and congratulating them. And it's so strange to hear a state agency get along with the feds, especially on the area of public lands law enforcement. So I think it shows that, hey, you know, if you let the political rhetoric, look past the political rhetoric, maybe the state and federal officials actually do get along and get important work done once in a while.
Sounds like a great story. Again, check it out, sltrib.com. Rachel, what's your pick?
You may have heard about this BYU. No, just kidding. The exciting news for anyone who is a sports fan is Utah's getting another indoor football team.
And really?
Yes, yes. And the Blaze, I think, shut down in 2013. And this team is yet to be named. So, you can speculate online which team name ending in a double Z they might go for.
Excellent. All right, Robert.
Well, you kind of stole the one I was going to do. I was going to plug that Utah Foundation story because I think it's really interesting to see the Utah Foundation surveyed delegates of the conventions and sort of mainstream members of the respective parties and found this huge disconnect between the priorities that the delegates have, these sort of the people who are making these decisions on the nominations versus the people who are the regular voters. And for example, in the air quality field, there was not a top 10 issue. It wasn't even an issue in the top 10 for the Republican delegates, but it was for the Republican voters. And so you see that the people who are making the decisions at these conventions, that there is sort of a disparity in the priorities between the people they're representing and the people that they're choosing to go to these conventions.
You'll get to see that firsthand tomorrow.
Yeah, I will.
Robert Gerke, Rachel Piper, Brian Maffley, thank you all very much for your time today.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Thank you. Have a good weekend.
You too.
Yeah.
We're going to wrap up this week with Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. This week, Kirby reveals the secret to successful family vacations.
I will give anything that keeps my wife happy. Not the kids or the grandkids, that keeps my wife happy. If mom's not happy, nobody is, as the saying goes. And so most of our vacations have been to go visit her family in Canada, which involves a really long drive from Salt Lake to Calgary. And when the kids were young, that was tough because they didn't want to sit, you know, the whole way through. So we'd end up stopping at motels as long as they had a pool and get there the next day.
So you wrote a column about deciding where to vacation.
Well, yeah, after years of taking a vacation and negotiating on everything, we finally came up with what we consider to be the perfect vacation. We each had a different version of that, but it came close to being the same thing. So I wrote in, this was in 2008. Some of the rules have changed since then because we had to factor in grandkids. But I wrote a column about it, and I said, the perfect vacation did not include being anywhere within 3,000 miles of an in-law, going to church on Sunday, dieting, riding large animals, phones, dysentery, or giving a damn about what the kids were doing. Conversely, the perfect vacation had to consist of such basics as clean water, fattening food, gorgeous sunsets, locking doors, long periods of unconsciousness, and the legal right to punch snotty waiters. Concessions had to be made. My wife agreed to go someplace historic, so long as she wasn't expected to relive the moment. I consented to not dragging her anywhere that room service could not be summoned with the press of a single button. We settled on a Mediterranean cruise. 12 days, her, me, MasterCard, and 40,000 other people on a boat off the shores of countries that hate us. Sounds vaguely familiar.
That sounds very nice. You've actually got a cruise coming up yourself.
Yes, we are. In a couple weeks, we're taking some of the grandkids on a Disney cruise, which after, you go on party cruises where everybody stays drunk but you, and that gets old really fast. So I'm actually looking forward to this.
Put your feet up.
Let the kids, grandkids go do whatever they want. And the only rule is don't fall off the boat.
That's Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. You can find all of the Kirby archives online at sltrib.com. That's it for this edition of Behind the Headlines, a production of KCPW Radio, Utah Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks so much to Roger McDonough at KCPW, Friend Weller and Danny Hayes at UPR, and Emily Means from the Tribune. A programming note, save the date this upcoming Thursday, April 28th, at Trolley Square in Salt Lake City. The Salt Lake Tribune is hosting a Pulitzer Prize-winning book party. We're going to be celebrating Pulitzer Prize-winning fiction, and this year's winners were announced this week. So if you're a reader out there, you know this is sort of a big time of year. If you want more information, go to the Salt Lake Tribune Facebook page, and there's all the details on the events. Tickets are just $5. We'd love to see you there. Thanks to Trolley Square and to Weller Bookworks, who are our co-sponsors. It's going to be a lot of fun, and we hope that you can make it. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks so much for listening to Behind the Headlines. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you next week.
Spring is a time for new beginnings, new births, and looking forward. But some people are so contrary, they can only look backward. That would be us. Join us as we review some fine times with Trisha Yearwood, Ice Cube, Tony Robbins, and the many identities of Bill Curtis. I'm Peter Sagal. It's never too early for nostalgia on this week's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Join us Saturday morning at 9 on Utah Public Radio.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, KCEU Price, and KUSU FM HD1 Logan.